The headlines: Palestinians warn Israel against entering the Jenin refugee camp, search for Palestinian inmates who managed to escape a high-security Israeli jail. The Syrian government forces raised the national flag in a strategic district in the city of Daraa following the withdrawal of foreign-backed militants. Also in the headlines, Iran's foreign minister says the current dire situation in Afghanistan is a result of the U.S.'s 20-year occupation. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Palestinian resistance movement Islamic Jihad has warned the Israeli regime against any raid on the Jenin refugee camp in search of six inmates who had managed to escape a high-security Israeli jail. Members of the Palestinian group said that they would resist and repel Israeli forces if they tried to enter the refugee camp. The Hamas resistance movement also said that the regime would be fully responsible for the consequences of its repressive actions against inmates. The warning came as regime troops began a manhunt using sniffer dogs and aircraft. Meanwhile, the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah warned Tel Aviv of the consequences of continued repression of Palestinians languishing in the regime's prisons. The six Palestinians escaped the prison earlier this week through an underground tunnel. Israeli forces have arrested several family members of those inmates. Ashraf Shannon is a correspondent who joins us from Gaza City. Ashraf, at this point, are there any indications that Israel is going to enter the Jenin refugee camp?
Well, Kaveh, that's very likely, because they've done this years ago and they committed a massacre against resistance fighters inside the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement has made has issued a strong warning to the Israeli regime, and I believe this situation could escalate not only in within the occupied West Bank, but also from the Gaza Strip, from Al-Quds, and also from any point of contact with the Israeli regime, also including the prisons itself. Currently, there are over two dozen Israeli prisons and detention centers housing around 5,000 Palestinian inmates, including women and children. Already, since yesterday morning, they started rioting against their captors, because the Israeli prison service, or IPS, in charge of the prisons inside the Israeli regime, has started interrogating the prisoners, moving them from one place to another, also handcuffing them to their beds and shackling them, and also Israeli police and the military have gone after the families of the six Palestinian freedom fighters who managed to tunnel themselves out of the Gilboa prison in northern occupied northern Palestine. So I believe, yes, we are heading towards an escalation, including the possibility of Israeli soldiers trying to enter the Jenin refugee camp. The Jenin refugee camp is known for being very strong with resistance fighters within the refugee camp itself. They battled the Israeli regime several times before, and I think they will do this again to protect the families of Palestinian prisoners, and also for Palestinians, the issue of prisoners is not a simple one. It's a sacred issue for all Palestinians. Palestinians regard the prisoners as freedom fighters, as political prisoners, and also since 1967 alone, around 1 million Palestinians were incarcerated by the Israeli regime. So in every Palestinian family, there's someone who is still in jail or inside Israeli jail, or spent some time inside Israeli jail, or been captured or beaten by Israeli forces. I remember myself when I was 14 years old, back in the 80s, just walking down the street in Gaza City. I was beat up, held for 2 days inside Israeli prison, and they had to let me go because they haven't done anything. They just beat me up and held me for the fun of it. They've been doing this for more than 50 years, And I think they will continue to do it because the Israeli regime has been emboldened by those Arab countries in the Persian Gulf who have normalized ties and opened embassies within the Israeli regime. And Palestinians feel betrayed. Not only they feel that the Palestinian cause has been betrayed, they feel stabbed in the back by those Arabs.
It appears that there's going to be a showdown at the Jenin refugee camp between the Israeli forces that are at some point going to enter that camp and, of course, the people there. What are people doing in order to get prepared for this and also to defend themselves?
Already dozens of Arab Palestinians within the occupied West Bank have made their way to the Jenin refugee camp, to members of the Fatah movement and also members of the Islamic Jihad movement and also the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine have managed to bring dozens of their fighters within the Jenin refugee camp itself. And I believe if a battle happens inside the Jenin refugee camp with the Israeli regime, Palestinian Zingas or the resistance fighters will also take part in that battle by firing rockets and engage Israeli soldiers from Gaza.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. From Gaza City, Ashraf Shannon, many thanks. Moving on, the Syrian army has taken control of a strategic area in the southwestern city of Daraa following a Russian-brokered ceasefire with militants holding out there. Syrian media say that government forces have entered Daraa al-Balad and have raised the national flag in the district. According to the official Sana'a news agency, Syrian troops have set up several checkpoints, purging the whole area. Weeks of clashes between the Syrian army and militants prompted Russia to mediate for a truce that came into force on September the 1st. Under the terms of the deal, militants must either leave Daraa al-Balad or hand over their firearms if they choose to remain. Dozens have already been bused to another militant-held territory in Syria's north. In what has been described as a victory for truth, a Western mainstream media channel has been found to have lied about an alleged chemical and biological weapons attack in Syria more than 3 years ago. The BBC has announced that a documentary that it aired last year contained, quote, serious flaws. Said Puriza has the details.
The hospital scenes of the April 2018 alleged chemical attack on the Syrian city of Duma are seared in the minds of people around the world. Blaming it on the Syrian government, Western mainstream media, among them the UK's public broadcaster, the BBC, gave it extensive coverage.
One such coverage included BBC4 documentary, Mayday, A Canister on the Bed, which aired last November, prompting complaints of inaccuracies. 10 months later, the corporation's own executive complaints unit has found that the piece created by one of its investigative journalists contains serious flaws. In other words, blatant lies.
The Syrian government denied ever having chemical weapons, much less used them against its own people. But that didn't stop the U.S., France, and the U.K. from carrying out a series of military strikes against multiple government sites in Syria.
This is a first for the BBC, but I think that it's partly a desperate attempt to try and gain credibility, that they aren't just an extension of Western deep state.
That was followed by an investigation by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW. But that didn't end well. The organization was called upon by many, among them some of its own former members, of suppressing its findings. Doubts about the veracity of what went down in Duma were raised before the recent BBC embarrassment. In 2019, BBC producer Riam Dalati dropped a bombshell saying the video footage of the alleged chemical attack had been staged.
After almost 6 months of investigations, I can prove without a doubt that the Duma hospital scene was staged. No fatalities occurred in that hospital.
And in the lead-up to the incident, Russia had warned it could happen, that the terrorists who controlled Duma at the time could stage a chemical attack, invite foreign intervention, and derail an evacuation deal.
In reality, most state-run media outlets in the West, in fact, most transnational corporation or corporate-run independent news channels, all have a particular line. That line tends to support the neoliberal imperialist narratives, regardless of what the truth is.
More than 3 years since the incident, the clouds of Western mainstream media propaganda and misinformation have cleared, and the truth has come out for everyone to see. Saeed Pourreza, Press TV, London.
Iran's president says the presence of foreign forces, especially those of the U.S. in Afghanistan, brought nothing but war, bloodshed, and destruction to the country. Ebrahim Raisi made the comments in a phone call with the European Council Chief Charles Michel. Said the 20-year U.S.-led NATO occupation also increased the production of opium in Afghanistan, 45 times more than what it was before. The Iranian president stressed that what Afghanistan needs now is a government trusted by its people. He added that the U.S. invasion proves that the problems in Afghanistan can't be resolved militarily. Raisi also said that Iran will do all that it can to protect the rights of the Afghan people. Iran's foreign minister has blamed the United States' 20-year occupation of Afghanistan for the current dire situation in that country. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said it is time now for leaders and people in Afghanistan to rebuild the country through available resources. Abdullahian added that leaders of neighboring countries must also help Afghanistan achieve a sustainable peace. The top Iranian diplomat was addressing a virtual meeting organized to discuss developments following the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. Foreign ministers from six countries, including Pakistan, China, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Tajikistan, participated in Wednesday's meeting. Reactions have been pouring in after the Taliban announced an all-male caretaker government ministers to lead Afghanistan following the group's rise to power. The European Union says the Taliban cabinet is not inclusive and lacks representative from different ethnic and religious groups. The UN agency has said the group's exclusion of women from the government puts a question mark on its commitment to protect the rights of women and girls. Washington has also expressed concern about the track records and affiliations of some of the ministers named by the Taliban. Meanwhile, China has expressed hope that the new Afghan government will be tolerant toward all.
The Chinese embassy in Afghanistan is functioning normally. We are ready to maintain communication with the new Afghan government and its leaders. We hope that the new Afghan government will listen to the views of all ethnic groups and factions and work in concert with the aspirations of its people and the expectations of the international community. We have noted that the Taliban has stressed that all people will benefit from the new regime.
The Taliban announced a caretaker government on Tuesday. The group's spokesman said that Hassan Akhund was appointed the acting prime minister, while the Taliban co-founder Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar would be the acting deputy premier. Sarajuddin Haqqani was appointed acting interior minister. The new government started its work on Wednesday. Taliban leader Hibatullah Akhundzadeh has promised that the group will uphold Islamic law in all matters of life and governance. He also pledged that the new leadership would ensure lasting peace, prosperity, and development in the country. Iran's army commander has lashed out at Israel for its recent threats, saying the regime is aware of its rapid decline and therefore probably wants to commit suicide out of fear. Major General Saeed Abdulrahim Mousavi made the comments while inspecting the preparation of armed forces units in the western province of Lorestan. He called the Israeli regime vulnerable, saying that it has experienced many heavy defeats in the past. The remarks came one day after the Israeli army chief said the regime, quote, has greatly accelerated preparations for action against Iran's nuclear program. He also claimed that the regime's current main objective is to minimize Iran's presence in West Asia. Last month, Israel issued a similar threat. Tehran has repeatedly warned that any military move by Israel would receive a crushing response. Political commentator Mustafa Khoshesh says the U.S. and Israeli threats of military actions against Iran are empty, that cannot scare the Islamic Republic.
Ever since Iran's nuclear dossier was put in the center stage by the Americans in 2002, the Israelis have been speaking of attacking Iranian nuclear facilities, increasingly and up until 2007 and 8, when Iran staged its first missile drills called Payambar-e-Azam-1, it was then that the Americans realized that Iran would not budge and would not be afraid of the Israeli threat. And then they called Israel back to replace Israel with U.S. military threats within the then recently formulated strategy of containment that works through exerting sanctions pressures as well as the threat, military threat pressures on Iranian decision makers in the hope that Tehran would budge. They go hand in hand in order to pose threats, but the Israelis are up front. The Israelis are notorious for undigested policies and moves when it comes to warmongering, and they hope that this bad reputation could move and jolt Iranian decision-makers, but they would never vote for military action. If it was working, they would have done that way earlier, 2 decades ago.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Recent spells of unusually cold winter weather in the United States and other parts of Northern Hemisphere could be a paradoxical consequence of the climate warming in the Arctic, according to a study based on decades of atmospheric observations. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Quirin Schiermeier. Writer, this article is published under the heading Freak Winters Linked to Arctic Warming. Stay tuned for more. Recent spells of unusually cold winter weather in the United States and other parts of Northern Hemisphere could be a paradoxical consequence of the climate warming in the Arctic, according to a study based on decades of atmospheric observations. However, it is still unclear whether this represents a long-term trend that will persist as the world heats up. The Arctic rate of warming is twice that for Earth as a whole, and some climate researchers have long suspected that this rapid Arctic warming can trigger anomalies in the winds around the North Pole, with consequences for weather thousands of kilometers further south. Conventional wisdom is that while global warming means more heat waves, it will definitely lead to less cold spells and snowfall, says Judah Cohen, a climate scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge and lead author of the study. But that's not quite true. There are mechanisms by which climate change can contribute to more severe winter weather too. One dominant feature of the winter atmosphere above the Arctic is a polar vortex, a fast-flowing band of high-altitude winds. The vortex normally isolates the atmosphere over the Arctic from warmer air closer to the equator. But when the polar vortex stretches and undulates, as it sometimes does, chilly air can leak out to latitudes that would otherwise rarely experience cold snaps. Such extreme weather can prove fatal in regions unprepared for frosty conditions. In February, at least 111 people died in Texas when cold Arctic air hit the state and parts of northern Mexico. In their study published recently in Science, Cohen and his colleagues compared 40 years of satellite observations of atmospheric conditions over the Arctic with experiments based on computational climate models. The models probed how a decline in Arctic sea ice and snow cover would affect air streams in the region, since ice and snow reflect a large fraction of incoming sunlight back into space, whereas the darker ocean and land surface absorb more radiation. This decline is known to drive Arctic warming. The researchers found that episodes of polar vortex stretching have markedly increased in the past few decades, and that their models reproduced this behavior well when they included the effects of Arctic warming. This is an insightful new analysis, says Dim Como, a climate scientist at the Free University Amsterdam in the Netherlands, who was not involved in the study. Its strength is that they have very carefully looked at a specific pattern of the polar vortex that is important for cold spells in particular places and backed up their observational analysis with climate modeling experiments. But the idea that Arctic warming might be responsible for cold spells in mid-latitude regions is still hotly debated among climate scientists. At first glance, it might seem obvious that winters will generally tend to get milder in a warming world, but climate models that are commonly used to study complex links between the different components of the climate system diverge on the issue of how strongly Arctic warming might influence mid-latitude winters, and state-of-the-art models do not accurately replicate observed trends in the behavior of the polar vortex. It remains to be seen whether the models are missing something or whether the observations of polar vortex stretching merely reflect natural climate variability, says Daniel Amati, a climate modeler at the Max Planck Institute of Meteorology in Hamburg, Germany, who was not involved in the study. The new analysis does not settle these questions, Matty says, although changes in the sea ice and snow cover do seem to have a role in wind anomalies high up above the Arctic. Other factors such as decadal variability in sea surface temperatures could also drive wintertime anomalies in the Arctic atmosphere that can lead to unexpectedly cold weather elsewhere. To complicate matters further, there are still significant uncertainties about how Earth's climate as a whole responds to snow and sea ice changes. For now, it remains unclear whether the recent examples of extreme winter cold are precedents for future weather. Climate change isn't linear, Matthew says. What happens in one decade may not apply in the next one.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
We thank Allah, and we don't have words to thank Him for allowing us to gather and commemorate Ashura and Muharram the way He did. It was a great blessing from Him and none other than Him. And we pray that as He gifted us the gift of Ashura and the remembrance of Ashura and the tears for Ashura and the latam and the beating of the chest for Ashura, that He helps us maintain the line of Ashura and progress to where we are at a higher rank of following direction and the path of Ashura and Muharram and Imam al-Hussein, inshallah. There is one last way that I would like to mention is important in the way we remember Imam al-Hussein that will cause us to be in line with Karbala and on the path of Karbala. And if we lose sight of this, we are not going to be able to continue to be on the path of Muharram. That is an approach towards Ashura that has to do with what happens after the material battle, the physical battle, the military conflict in Karbala was over. The school of Karbala, the uprising of Karbala, didn't end on the 10th of Muharram. 10th of Muharram is the end of the military confrontation and that form of battle. As they say, the qital ended, begun and ended on the 10th of Muharram. The jihad, however, against tyranny, against the enemies of Islam, against Yazid particularly, at that time did not end. It continued. In fact, if it wasn't for the continuity, if it wasn't for Imam Zain al-Abidin as the leader following Imam al-Hussein, all others in Karbala understood that their Imam after Imam al-Hussein is Imam Zain al-Abidin. Be it that he is ill, he cannot be too physically active, he is the one that leads, he instructs, and the instructions came from him. The direction is the direction of Imam Zain al-Abidin. If it wasn't for Imam Zain al-Abidin and those under, now the Ashab are predominantly women and children, the ones that are following instructions and who are part of this part of the struggle, this part of the jihad, are predominantly, in fact, entirely women and children. There is no other man that is with them. It's only Imam Zain al-Abidin. The fighters of this jihad are women and children. If it wasn't for the Imam and his companions and followers continuing, and the end of the battle would have been the end of the jihad, then the movement of Imam al-Hussein would not have had the impact that it did. It was because of Imam Zain al-Abidin continuing the struggle that it had the impact. And I should say, this is something that is mentioned less, I believe, but I think it's something that needs to be mentioned. If it wasn't for each of our imams, up to today, Imam al-Hujjah, ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, up to today, during these times, if it wasn't for him continuing the struggle, if it wasn't for Imam al-Baqir and Imam al-Sadiq, all the imams, if it wasn't for them continuing this jihad and this struggle, you wouldn't have these Muharram congregations. They would have died long ago or transformed into meaningless celebrations, the same way that when the people that were descendants of Ibrahim and Ismail, Quraysh were descendants of Ibrahim and Ismail, but they didn't have prophets amongst them, Rusul amongst them. The teachings of Ibrahim and Ismail that were Hajj for commemorating Tawheed, for remembering Tawheed, for worshipping the one God, for everyone gathering to walk around the Kaaba 7 times in order to worship the one God, that form and structure remained of Hajj. But instead of the ihram of Hajj, they would come and walk around it without any clothes on, completely nude. Worshipping, worst of all, the form of it changed some slightly. Worst of all, instead of it being worshipping the one God, it turned into worshipping multitudes of gods. Kaaba became the center of shirk, with the same rituals. Hajj was a ritual handed down by Ibrahim. They preserved that ritual. It was there. The Prophet didn't have to remind them of and tell them, oh, there's something called Hajj. They already knew Hajj. He didn't have to remind them of something like Umrah. There's something called Umrah. No. They already knew what that was. Change form. The reason why the movement of Imam al-Hussein stayed alive, remained alive, has gained momentum over these years is because there has always been a leader that has continued the struggle, the jihad. And we really do owe this to Imam for our time and our day and age. To the Imam of our time. Let's not forget, he is the sun behind the cloud. That means all these blessings, this light that you see, it's due to him. Although clouds of ghaibah are preventing us from seeing that sun, we see the effects. The spreading of the culture of Ashura, not just the beating of the chest, these are ways of us connecting to it. We have ceremonies to help us with that, and we try to keep them on track as we have spoken these nights. That's the idea, to keep it. But what causes this to be kept on the right tracks is those leaders that have made sure it remains, and above all are the Ahlul Bayt themselves. Without them, and them continuing this, we wouldn't have had what we have today in Ashura.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Matin شاكرٌ ودود قيومٌ رؤوف صابرٌ مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Expanded unemployment benefits that have kept millions of Americans afloat during the pandemic expired on Monday, 6th of September, setting up an abrupt cutoff of assistance to 7.5 million people as the Delta variant of the coronavirus rattles the pandemic recovery. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Jim Tankersley and Ben Castleman. The piece is titled, Unemployment Benefits Expire for Millions Without Pushback from Biden. Expanded unemployment benefits that have kept millions of Americans afloat during the pandemic expired on Monday, 6th of September, setting an abrupt cutoff of assistance to 7.5 million people as the Delta variant of the coronavirus rattles the pandemic recovery. The end of the aid came without objection from President Biden and his top economic advisors, who have become caught in a political fight over the benefits and are now banking on other federal help and an autumn pickup in hiring to keep vulnerable families from foreclosure and food lines. The $1.9 trillion economic aid package President Biden signed back in March included extended and expanded benefits for unemployed workers, like a $300 per week federal supplement to state jobless payments, additional weeks of assistance for the long-term unemployed, and the extension of a special program to provide benefits to so-called gig workers who traditionally do not qualify for unemployment benefits. The expiration date reached on Monday, 6th of September, means that 7.5 million people will lose their benefits entirely, and another 3 million people will lose the $300 weekly supplement. Republicans and small business owners have assailed efforts to extend the aid, contending that it has held back the economic recovery and fueled a labor shortage by discouraging people from looking for work. Liberal Democrats and progressive groups have pushed for another round of aid, saying millions of Americans remain vulnerable and in need of help. President Biden and his advisors have pointedly refused to call on Congress to extend the benefits further, a decision that reflects the prevailing view of the state of the recovery inside the administration and the president's desire to focus on winning support for his broader economic agenda. The president's most senior economic advisors say the economy is in the process of completing a handoff between the federal assistance and the labor market. As support from the March stimulus law wanes, they say more and more Americans are set to return to work, drawing paychecks that will power consumer spending in the place of government aid. And President Biden is pushing Congress this month to pass two measures that constitute a multi-trillion dollar agenda focused on long-run economic growth. A bipartisan infrastructure bill and a larger partisan spending bill, with investments in childcare, education, carbon reduction, and much more. That push leaves no political oxygen for an additional short-term aid bill, which White House officials insist the economy does not need. Administration officials say money that continues to flow to Americans from the March law, including new monthly payments to parents, will continue to sustain the social safety net, even as the expanded federal jobless aid expires. President Biden has called on certain states, those with high unemployment rates and a willingness to continue aid to jobless workers, to use state relief funds from the March law to help the long-term unemployed. So far, no state has said it plans to do so. On Sunday, President Biden's chief of staff, Ron Klein, told CNN's State of the Union program that the March law was also allowing states to help those out of work by offering employment bonuses and job training and job counseling. "We think the jobs are there," Ron Klein said, "and we think the states have the resources they need to move people from unemployment to employment." President Biden has faced criticism from both the left and the right on the issue, and he has responded with a balancing act, supporting the benefits as approved by Congress, but declining to push to extend them, or to defend them against attacks by leaders in some states. Throughout the summer months, business lobbyists and Republican lawmakers called on the president to cut off the benefits early, blaming them for the difficulties some businesses were facing in hiring workers, particularly in lower-paying industries such as the hospitality industry. Soon after the backlash began, President Biden defended the benefits but called on the Labor Department to ensure that unemployed workers who declined job offers would lose their aid. But roughly half of the states, nearly all of them led by Republican governors, moved to cut off benefits early on their own. President Biden and his administration did not fight them, angering progressives. The administration is essentially extending that policy into the fall by calling on only winning states to fill in for expired assistance. "I don't think we necessarily need a blanket policy for unemployment benefits at this point around the country," Labor Secretary Martin Walsh said in an interview on Friday, "because states are in different places." Privately, some administration officials have expressed openness to the idea that economic research will eventually show that the benefits had some sort of chilling effect on workers' decisions to take jobs. Critics of the extra unemployment benefits have argued that they are discouraging people from returning to work at a time when there are a record number of job openings and many businesses are struggling to hire. Evidence so far suggests that programs are playing at most a limited role in keeping people out of the workforce. States that ended the benefits early, for example, have seen little, if any, pickup in hiring relative to the rest of the country. Even in the industries that have had the hardest time finding workers, many people don't expect a sudden surge in job applications once the benefits expire. Other factors, childcare challenges, fear of the virus, accumulated savings from previous waves of federal assistance, and a broader rethinking of work preferences in the wake of the pandemic are also playing a role in keeping people out of work. "I think it's a piece of the puzzle, but I don't think it's the big piece," said Ben Felicia, the Director of Operations and Strategy for the Pennsylvania Restaurant and Lodging Association. "It's easy to point to, but I don't think it's the true reason." Progressives in and outside of Congress have grown frustrated with the administration's approach to the benefits, warning it could backfire economically. Job growth slowed in August as the Delta variant spread across the country. Millions of jobless workers are going to suffer when benefits expire on Monday, 6th of September, and it didn't need to be this way, said Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat from Oregon and the chairman of the Finance Committee. Senator Ron Wyden added, "It's clear from economic and health conditions on the ground that we shouldn't be cutting off benefits now." Elizabeth Ananat, a Barnard College economist who has been studying the impact of the pandemic on low-wage workers, said that cutting off benefits now, when the Delta variant of the coronavirus has threatened to set back the recovery, was a threat to both workers and the broader economy. Elizabeth Ananat added, "We've got this fragile economic recovery and now we're going to cut income from people who need it, and we're pulling back dollars out of an economy that is still pretty unsteady. Elizabeth Ananat has been tracking a group of about 1,000 low-income parents in Philadelphia, all of whom were working before the pandemic. More than half lost their jobs early in the pandemic last year. By this summer, 72% were working, reflecting the strong rebound in the economy as a whole. But that still left 28% of the group who were unemployed, either because they could not find work or because of childcare or other responsibilities. We're going into new school year, where there's going to be a lot of more uncertainty than there was this spring for parents, Ms. Ananat said. Employers are again going to be dealing with a situation where they have people who want to work, but what the heck are they supposed to do when their kids get sent home to quarantine?
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
February 8, 2010. I saw nothing but beauty, Zainab al-Kubra. On the day of Ashura, Zainab al-Kubra watched many of her dear ones go to the battlefield to get martyred. She watched Hussein ibn Ali, Abbas, Ali Akbar, Qasim, her children, and other dear ones go to the battlefield. After they were martyred, she went through all those pains. The invasion of the enemy, disrespect, and the responsibility to take care of the surviving children and women. Is it possible to compare the enormity of this tragedy with physical pain? But when she was faced with these difficulties, Zainab al-Kubra did not tell God to save her. She did not say, "Oh my Lord, save me." While the shredded body of her brother lay in front of her eyes, tells God, "O God, accept this sacrifice from us." When she was asked to describe what she had seen, she replied, "I did not see anything but beauty." All those tragedies were beautiful to Zainabul Kubra because they were from and for God, because they were supposed to promote the word of God.
Ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum. أنا لاتشان.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لاتشان. أنا لاتشان.
Zainab entered the heart of threats for the sake of Allah, the Exalted. February 8, 2010. What Zainab did was divine. That is to say, she went into the heart of threats and hardships for the sake of Allah the Exalted. It behooves us to know and to understand our glorious religious history, which has been a source of intellectual blessings so far, and which will hopefully benefit us until the end of time. Zainab played an unparalleled role on the way to Karbala with Imam Hussein, on the day of Ashura, with all those hardships, and after Imam Hussein had been martyred. It is impossible to find a similar figure in history. Later on, numerous events took place during her captivity in Kufa and in Sham. Because of these great selfless efforts, Zainabul Kubra gained a prominent position before Allah the Exalted, and this is something that we cannot describe.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.